In 1904, Birmingham was in the midst of a population explosion. The number of people was about to quadruple to more than 130,000 by the end of the first decade of the 20th century. Birmingham had become one of the fastest growing and largest urban areas in the country, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, and it was only 30 years old. But it was hard to tell where all those people were. A lot of them went underground, literally.
You can leave me if you want to. I'm giving you a break. But don't come back home crying over your mistake. I've got a man in the Bama mine.
Those Bama mines Merlene Johnson sang about were full of stories. Hard, dirty work, along with dreams and aspirations to make money in this new city. The entire region had been decimated from the Civil War. Reconstruction was slow. But Birmingham was ground zero for the Southern Industrial Revolution. An abundance of iron ore, limestone, and coal were ingredients for making pig iron. Iron turned into pipe and valves, or into rolled steel and hard metals. People had come from all over the nation and world for this rush. And one man, well, not man, God, God with a little g, was born of this revolution. The statue Vulcan was cast like everything else in Birmingham, in a foundry, out of pig iron, and that's what made him such an appropriate addition at the time.
It symbolized the success of the Southern industry headquartered in Birmingham.
Marjorie White is executive director of the Birmingham Historical Society.
By 1904, Birmingham had become the world's largest producer of iron, and Vulcan shouted that out to the world in great triumph, and also said we can produce steel, what they wanted in the early 20th century, and we can produce it in gigantic quantities as large as the Roman god Vulcan.
But Vulcan was more than mere cast iron pipe. It was 55 feet of in-your-face advertising concocted by a commercial club looking for publicity at the St. Louis World's Fair. Vulcan represented everything that sculptor Giuseppe Moretti saw that the people of Birmingham could do, work hard, and overcome enormous odds. We used a little creative license, a thick Italian accent, and the words to an historical play by Theater UAB's Lee Shackelford to listen in on what Moretti might say if confronted about his big, bulky, and yes, somewhat homely mythological tribute to Birmingham's industry.
He maketh such things of iron and steel that even those of gods of themselves are started to envy. He taketh the dirt and the rocks, and he heated them in the fires, and he beat them with his hammer, and he shaped them with the beauty in his soul. And with his great genius in his mind, and with the steaming sweat from his blazing brow, he take all of this lifeless black rocks, and he bring up some beauty, and some wonder, and some power.
That's actor Sam Chalker for a Reader's Theater piece, Tale of the Iron Man, written a few years ago. As is so typical of the boy gets cast, boy wows everyone at the World's Fair, boy comes home story, there are many subplots, but one cannot be overshadowed. Vulcan didn't just witness one economic transformation, he's actually seen two. For years, during and after the Civil War, people had known about North Central Alabama's geographic blessings. Iron furnaces at Tannehill in Jefferson County and Briarfield in Bibb County were used to make armaments during the war. Tannehill was destroyed by the Union Army. Briarfield didn't survive Reconstruction. In the years after the war, the money dried up and the economy was very weak. But railroads helped to change all that. Lines that had been started before the war would soon make their way from town to town across the South, and that helped to foster growth in each of those towns. And if there was growth because of one rail line, imagine a place where there were two. In what was then an area known as Elaton, the South and North Line and the Alabama and Chattanooga Line intersected, and founding fathers, already aware of the special ingredients that it bore underground, gave it the name of the English industrial mecca, Birmingham.
Now it's a train, train on the track, I'm Alabama bound.
Birmingham, as it would become known here in the States, became a bustling young city. With the railroads and a reputation for industry, people came looking for work. Those who were here needed only look to the ground to see what the future held. On Red Mountain, where Vulcan stands today, there are some of the most fertile iron ore seams in the world. At least 5 coal fields, all varying in size, are west and north of the city. Limestone deposits are nearby as well. Because each of the ingredients are so close to one another and so abundant, the Historical Society's Marjorie White says Birmingham has always had an industrial advantage.
Birmingham is here because of the presence of minerals in our soils, of coal, iron ore, and limestone, and the ability of men to make them into first raw iron. It was 30 years after the founding of the city that they figured out how to use these minerals to make steel. And that actually is the moment at which Vulcan is cast.
Birmingham quickly became a metallurgic empire. White says the Chamber of Commerce even proclaimed it with a sign on the front of their First Avenue North building.
It said you could find all the raw materials for making iron and steel within gunshot distance of this place.
And how far is that?
Gunshot distance? Evidently they could shoot for a mile and a half.
And so coal mines were dug, and iron foundries and steel plants were built. Thousands of people worked in those plants and foundries, producing more iron and eventually more steel than any other city in the country, with the exception of Pittsburgh or Gary, Indiana. Some workers came from the North. Others were immigrants, new to the United States. But according to the Alabama Department of Archives and History, a vast majority of hard laborers were impoverished African American men. Some former slaves, others descendants of slaves. For them, working conditions were the worst. Miners were subjected to intense heat and poor breathing conditions. Foundry workers put in 12 and 15-hour days.
It was very dangerous work. And you could be killed by rock falling, the mine caving in, gases, and all other kind of hazards that were in the mine.
The Reverend Abraham Woods is president of the Birmingham chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. One way, he says, blacks were subjected to the hard, dangerous, and cheaper work was through the justice system. Justice, he says, was loosely defined in those days.
Blacks were arrested and convicted for nothing. Lottery, you have no visible job. So there were many blacks who got caught up in the convict system who had done nothing. It was a way of keeping convicts and certainly using blacks for that dangerous work.
All for pennies on the white man's dollar. It foreshadowed something that would later overshadow Birmingham's early industrial success, the civil rights movement. Everyone suffered when the stock market crashed in 1929. When the Depression hit America, Marjorie White says Birmingham took a particularly bad hit.
I mean, the old adage is hard times came to Birmingham and stayed longest.
How so?
A lot of unemployment.
Orders for iron and steel dropped by half. Fewer orders meant fewer workers, but the mills, mines, and factories never shut down completely. And during that time, about the middle 1930s, the symbol of Birmingham's industry, Vulcan, was moved from the state fairgrounds, where he'd overlooked the Midway and Farmax for 30 years, to Red Mountain. City leaders wanted him to stand atop those big iron ore seams. But despite Vulcan's proud posture atop a pedestal built by the Works Progress Administration, the American economy was slow to recover, and Birmingham was even slower. Iron and steel production was still below pre-Depression numbers, and it would take an attack, a day that would live in infamy, to get Birmingham's industrial engine back into gear. On December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. That very day, Johnny Rutledge started his job at U.S. Steel's Fairfield Works. But because of the attack, Rutledge did what a lot of other 18-year-olds did. He enlisted for battle. And after several tours of duty in Europe that included the deadly Battle of the Bulge, he returned home to find a reinvigorated industrial society in Birmingham and the haze and the smoke to prove it.
When I came home from the war, I moved over in West End on Alabama Avenue and then to Fairfield. In both of those places, every morning you had to sweep the cinders and soot off your porch, and ever so often clean out your window sills and things.
Birmingham's steel production was nearing its peak by then, the mid to late 1940s, churning out 3.3 million tons a year. That is nearly triple the amount of just a few years before. At 81 years old, Rutledge is still working today. He is a machinist doing general repairs at Fairfield. When something breaks down in the mill, he and many others make a new part for it.
When I came in there, we had about 500 men. Three shifts. Right now, we have about 8 men left in this shop.
He says the work of hundreds can be done with one computer or one robotic arm. No more men doing all the heavy lifting. Technology has transformed steelmaking. In 1951, according to the Birmingham Historical Society's book, The Birmingham District, expansion of U.S. Steel's Fairfield Works with new open-hearth steel furnaces allowed for a capacity of 4.2 million tons of steel to be produced. Through the next 10 years, production would exceed 3 million tons, more than 70% of capacity. Today, despite competition from foreign steel imports, production totals about 2.2 million tons out of a capacity of 2.4 million, more than 90% capacity. While overall total capacity is down, the percentage of production is up. Steelmaking's become more efficient.
Birmingham remains the South's largest industrial workplace.
Even today?
Even today. Yes, industry, heavy industry, forms a substantial core of our economy even today.
But because of technology, fewer hands have control of it today. 28,000 people worked for U.S. Steel in Birmingham in the 1940s and 50s. Just 1,800 have jobs there today. Machines are doing most of the work now. At the Fairfield Works, molten is rapidly cooled and stretched and rolled and tightly wound into 10-inch thick sheets, which form huge cylinders to be shipped to customers all over the world. Tons of steel make its way out of Birmingham every year. And for that matter, cast iron pipe, not pig iron, but ductile iron made from scrap, is still hot. More than 50% of the cast iron pipe produced in the United States comes from the Magic City. Yet according to the latest census data, the number of employees working in primary metals manufacturing has dropped from 18% of the Birmingham metropolitan population in 1950 to about 1% today. So where did all those workers go?
Union boys are free.
Gradually, through the 1960s, it was a combination of technology and increased steel competition that ensured most of the people who had worked in primary metals, many of whom were union members, needed to find other things to do. The Reverend Abraham Wood says the black community, which made up 40% of the population, was especially hard hit.
We were left to do the dirty work, the dangerous work, and we did it. And so when they declined, that certainly caused a greater depression, so far as economics was concerned, for black folk. And it was a very distressing time to see that happening.
In the 1950s and 60s, demonstrators, including the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, took to the streets to protest segregation and marched for jobs and equal opportunity.
And so whatever the economy was, Negroes was on the bottom. That said something.
The Reverend Shuttlesworth and hundreds of other protesters were regularly met by Birmingham's police force and the orders by Public Safety Commissioner Eugene Bull Connor to turn the fire hoses and dogs on them.
I'm tired of being Jim Crow. Don't leave this Jim Crow.
Segregation and racial strife were slow to end in Birmingham. Violence continued in the streets. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was jailed in the city. Homes of civil rights leaders, including the Reverend Shuttlesworth and attorney Arthur Shores, were bombed, as was the basement of the 16th Street Baptist Church on the morning of Sunday, September 15, 1963. Four young girls were killed in that attack. It wasn't the magical growth or the iron and steel industry that garnered attention. This time the world's eyes were on Bombingham, as it became known. But other positive changes were taking place on the city's south side. A budding medical school was taking shape in this city that once prided itself on sweat and toil. And that is no coincidence, says the Birmingham Historical Society's Marjorie White.
I mean, the economy today, in many respects, pulls out of our industrial past. When you have an industrial economy, you have lots of accidents and needs for lots of doctors.
She says Birmingham's healthcare economy traces back to the days of the mills, foundries, and factories. The University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa saw the need to relocate its medical school to Birmingham because of the city's growth and because it's where the doctors were most needed. One early graduate of the medical school was Dr. Charles Scotty McCallum, who had transferred to Birmingham in 1951. Now mayor of Vestavia Hills, McCallum says attracting highly regarded faculty for the fledgling school was tough.
In the 1950s and 1960s, to recruit somebody to come to Birmingham was very difficult.
Why was it difficult?
Because Birmingham did not have a sterling reputation.
But despite all the negative reviews of Birmingham, Dr. McCallum says early school leaders prevailed and growth picked up significantly. Dr. Tinsley Harrison, the former chair of the Department of Medicine, Drs. Joseph Volker and S. Richardson Hill, both vice presidents for health affairs, and Dr. John Kirkland, the heart researcher and surgeon, all put the best possible face on the situation, and they managed to recruit some of the country's best faculty and doctors.
It was exciting, and I think a lot of people that came here stayed, and they didn't leave, and there was a continuity of leadership and vision with Dick Hill and people like that John Kirkland, that felt we could take something and could start anew.
It was the beginning of another economic transformation, the likes of which Giuseppe Moretti and his famous statue Vulcan would have seen in their day. In 1969, by act of the Alabama legislature, the University of Alabama at Birmingham, or UAB, was born. Dr. McCallum would later serve as UAB president from 1986 to 1993. In more than 50 years in Birmingham, he says he witnessed a small three-building medical school turn into a world-renowned research and healthcare facility through an unusual series of events.
Usually you have a university and they establish medical schools or health science centers, but in this case it was reversed in that the emphasis relative to health and the establishment of the medical school originally and the University Hospital gave birth to a university, and the growth that has taken place here in this community of the university, I doubt will be replicated again in the United States. It's been phenomenal, and in my estimation, has served the city and state very well.
Today, UAB is the largest employer in Alabama with more than 16,000 workers. Ironically, U.S. Steel used to top that list. Healthcare and social assistance jobs in Jefferson County account for more than 14% of the workforce. Medical schools within UAB consistently rank in the top 20 in National Institutes of Health grants. The size of the campus went from a few square blocks in 1950 to more than 80 square blocks today, and it seems like there's construction going on everywhere at UAB. As a matter of fact, there are some who call UAB and its expanding territory the university that ate Birmingham. But not too far from campus, there is a different kind of feeding frenzy going on. On any given weekday, millions of pieces of paper, credits and debits, are fed through proof or encoding machine to the Compass Bank Harry Brock Operations Center on 32nd Street and 7th Avenue South. Checks and deposit slips and vouchers are encoded and moved along to processing where checking and savings accounts are deducted from or added to, or loan and credit card payments are credited. Birmingham can credit a growing banking industry to a couple of things that happened over the last 25 years. In the early 1980s, Alabama legislation allowed for a bank's separate branches to merge into one bank chartered in the state, intra-state banking. A few years later, in the mid-1980s, federal laws were loosened to allow one bank to buy another out-of-state bank, interstate banking. Jerry Powell is general counsel for Birmingham-based Compass Bankshares.
The market became open, and the only limitations which were that you had to buy an existing bank. You couldn't go and start a bank from scratch. So that opened the market up.
For example, after the gradual deregulation in the 1980s, Powell's company Compass, what was then Central Bank, bought existing branches in Texas, first in Houston, then Dallas. Other banks moved into the Florida Panhandle and Georgia. A few years ago, AmSouth bought Tennessee's largest bank, First American, in Nashville. More recently, Regions is acquiring Memphis-based First Union and will become one of the nation's 15 largest banks after the merger. The combined company will continue to be called Regions and continue to be headquartered in Birmingham. But consolidation giveth and consolidation taketh away. Earlier this summer, Charlotte, North Carolina-based Wachovia Bank announced it would acquire Birmingham-based SouthTrust for $14.3 billion, shaking up Birmingham's financial services community. When the merger is complete by late next year, the SouthTrust name will go away, and so will a longtime corporate citizen in Birmingham. University of Alabama Professor of Finance and Chair of Banking Dr. Benton Gupp says that will have far-reaching economic implications.
Because corporate headquarters tend to be more generous than branches. They participate a lot more in charitable giving and things of that nature. And we're going to be losing some positions here as well. So it's going to have a negative impact on Birmingham. It's also going to adversely affect the state and state banking department because they're no longer going to be able to regulate this bank or examine it or receive the revenues from it.
But Gupp says the SouthTrust deal doesn't mean Alabama's other big banks have bullseyes on their backs.
Well, they've always been in the target of other large mega banks, and conversely, our banks have always grown by buying other banks. So it's a continuing process of consolidation. The fact that SouthTrust was bought by another bank, it does not indicate that one of our other banks is immediately going on the block.
Compass Bank's Jerry Powell says historically it's because Alabama has a strong track record.
The banking laws are good. The ability to grow the bank on an interstate basis is sound and reasonable. One of the real significant reasons why we're here is a quality workforce at a competitive price.
Even after the Wachovia-SouthTrust merger, Birmingham-based banks are still expected to hold more than $150 billion in assets. Before the merger, the city ranked 8th in the nation in total assets and has more large top 50 banks headquartered in it than Atlanta, Chicago, and San Francisco. Locally, more than 8% of Jefferson County's workforce is in financial services. According to the Alabama Center for Business and Economic Research, commercial banking payrolls in 2001 topped $1 billion in Alabama. Dr. Jennings Marshall is professor of business at Samford University. He says the banking boom has been hard to stop given the rapid rise in Birmingham's financial sector.
Birmingham is an attractive place to be. In other words, you have the body of knowledge. In other words, banks need people that understand banking to work for them. And these great big banks that are located here and are running their facilities here have created a large labor pool that has expertise in banking.
The same can be said about the healthcare industry as well. And that could mean the future of Birmingham's two biggest service industries is bright, right? A future that would make even Vulcan proud? Well, there are a few variables and challenges in Birmingham's new transformed economy. Birmingham grew from a young iron and steel town to a more advanced healthcare and financial services town. But now that a second economic transformation has taken place, how has Birmingham survived the competition with other cities? It's done a good job so far. Take, for example, Buffalo, New York, a city similar in size and blue-collar background with an unemployment rate today of 7.5%. Buffalo had the highest jump in the nation in the past year. But Birmingham's unemployment rate was 4.2% in April. That's down 0.1% from a year ago. And smaller industrial cities such as Gary, Indiana, and Akron, Ohio, have higher unemployment rates and have yet to find ways out of their dependence on manufacturing, in their cases, steel and tires. Compared to those places, Birmingham is in the midst of an economic renaissance.
Well, clearly, Birmingham started very much as a steel town, steel and railroads. And now we really have a knowledge economy here, and the knowledge economy is connected principally to biomedical. And it is the wave of the future for us.
UAB President Dr. Carol Garrison says the biomedical or biotech industry is big business to the university.
We're primed right now. We're in a very positive position to look forward to another decade or two of remarkable growth.
Dr. Richard Marques is Senior Associate Dean for Biomedical Research at UAB.
There are very few medical schools in the future that are going to be able to carry out all three missions of education, research, and service, and we're going to do it very well. I think we're one of the few places that is going to be able to keep this tripartite mission. Our research engine is as strong as it's ever been. We have made a lot of terrific hires in the last few years. We're counting on the space in the Shelby building to allow us to continue to expand.
Research inside that 12-story Shelby Interdisciplinary Biomedical Research Building, which is now under construction, is expected to examine the causes of diseases ranging from multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis to brain disorders and osteoporosis.
When we write these NIH grants, we very often get them funded. They bring jobs that are well-paying. There aren't issues having to do with pollution associated with these jobs. We are a real economic developer for the city.
And there's lots of money to be made. Just like at the turn of the 20th century when venture capitalists helped fund new coal mines, mills, and foundries in young Birmingham, today's biotech industry is also soliciting for future expansion. Investors got an up-close look at Birmingham's more modern economic engines several weeks ago. That's when 15 Alabama biotech companies, many of them that work with UAB, went looking for additional funding and presented their ideas to prospective financiers at the Investors' Choice Conference at the Birmingham Marriott.
I think what I'm here is an example of, you know, how you can succeed in Birmingham with a high-tech company. I mean, there's a lot of good technology around.
Dr. Matthew Gonda is board chair of the Biotechnology Association of Alabama and president and CEO of Transmolecular Incorporated. His Birmingham biotech company recently closed on more than $33 million in financing for more of its research into cancer drugs.
Our investors have invested in Birmingham from all over the world. We have investors from Europe, Canada, Korea, Taiwan, as well as the United States. So we've really pulled in a good group of investment people.
Those investors are seeing advances in research at a number of Birmingham-based biotech firms. Southern Research Institute, which is affiliated with UAB, Vaxin, and the publicly traded BioCryst Pharmaceuticals have been conducting clinical trials on a host of drugs, some of which, the Southern Research Cancer Drug Discoveries, have already been approved by the Food and Drug Administration and marketed. But here's the challenge. Birmingham is either slow in gaining a reputation for biotech funding or omitted altogether. In the latest Business Facilities magazine survey identifying the 40 top biotech areas in the United States, Birmingham didn't even make the list. However, Raleigh-Durham ranked 7th, and Atlanta, Nashville, Memphis, and New Orleans all ranked in the top 40. As for Birmingham's banking and financial services industry, it's not finding the money, it's keeping the money here, the billions in assets that the big Birmingham banks hold. It's not a matter of venture capitalism, but venturing to stay independent in light of recent mergers, or to maintain the headquarters in Birmingham. Again, Samford University's Dr. Jennings Marshall.
Some of them could be targets for an acquisition. But they are very good at acquiring banks, and so they're in the process of growing. And so from my perspective, I think the future's bright, and I think the banks we have here are going to continue to grow and acquire other banks, and that Birmingham will continue to be a major financial center.
But what if one of those banks moves on its own? What if another city or state tries to persuade one of Birmingham's banks to move away?
We are like a Honda or a Mercedes-Benz. We are an attractive corporate citizen that they would love to have.
Compass Bankshares General Counsel Jerry Powell says it is the nature of business, city and state leaders wooing corporations.
Oh, they do. They are every day. We have somebody from Texas or Florida or Georgia or somebody want to entice us to come to their state. So
they do. They say, bring the corporate headquarters to Texas.
Oh, yes. And if we were wanting to go to Texas, we could go sit down and talk to them, and they would be willing to talk to us about incentives to come to Texas. So, But that's true of every state.
Powell says that scenario is not likely given the low cost of living and operating in Birmingham. Sounds like the way people thought 100 years ago. At the turn of the last century, the turn of the 20th century, the symbol of Birmingham's economic prowess was a cast iron statue erected to advertise the will and the might of the Birmingham district. Who knows what sculptor Giuseppe Moretti would think of his big, bulky iron god and the new industries it oversees today. Again, a little creative license and the acting skills of Sam Chalker bring us The Tale of the Iron Man by Theater UAB's Lee Shackelford.
You be up on that mountain now and for always. I want you to keep a good watch over this fine people. You stand up there tall and strong, so people can look up to you and remember. And when these people from around here, they get together on something, and they put their minds and their hearts and their backs into whatever they do, there is nothing that is impossible for them. You are the greatest proof of that. You, my beautiful, ugly man, you are the greatest proof.
Today's proof is more metropolitan, less cut and dry, or in Vulcan's case, cast and cooled. Maybe it's all the construction cranes, or storks as they're known, that dot the campus of UAB. Maybe it's the skyline downtown with some of the tallest buildings in Alabama that read like an address book of some of the nation's largest banks. But those are all tangible objects. And yes, Vulcan, too, is tangible. But he also has a personality, a face. And on the 100th anniversary of his completion, the Historical Society's Marjorie White says Vulcan could very well be the symbol that leads Birmingham through the 21st century.
At this point, he's up there to remind us that industry created the engine that gave birth to this city and this place and the reason we're here.
The hard work and enormous odds overcome are just as meaningful today as they were in 1904. That's our special report, Economic Irony. Thanks for joining us this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Good night.
All I hate about buckback track, turn in the bushes and jump right back. Old track bug jumping. Hey! Come up in one.
All right. If I could, I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood. If I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood. I don't know, but I've been told Susie had a jelly roll. I don't know. But I didn't know that Susie had a jelly roll.
All right.
Out of red and out of blue, I got a gal named Ida too. Oh boy, oh yeah. Oh boy, oh yeah. Oh boy, oh yeah.